Very good. All right. I appreciate so very much Steve's presentation there. He covered an awful lot of territory. And pardon me, I'm going to do my very, very dead level best to cover all of what I consider to be the major and pertinent issues that that he brought up. I understand exactly where he's coming from, but I'm going to try to go through them and cover them. I would like to point out, first of all, that Steve's actual proposition is that he is affirming the second coming of Christ and resurrection at the end of the current Christian age. That's the actual proposition. Well, I would like to point out there's an inherent problem with that, because the Bible affirms that the current Christian age has no end. In passage after passage after passage, the Bible speaks of the kingdom of Christ as that which has no end. So that obviously raises a very pertinent question. How can that which has no end come to an end? In Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, in describing the kingdom of God, it says, "He shall be the God of heaven shall set up a kingdom that shall never pass away." In Luke chapter 1, 32 and following, when the angel was speaking to Mary, he says, "The kingdom of David and the throne of David shall be given to him, and of his kingdom and of his throne there will be no end." In Revelation chapter 11, 15 and following, at the destruction of the city that where the Lord was slain, it says, "The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ, and they shall reign forever and forever." Greg Beale, in his commentary on the book of Revelation, says the Greek term that is found there is the strongest expression in the Greek language for unendingness. Hebrews chapter 12 describes the kingdom that they were receiving in the first kingdom, first century, and it says, "Wherefore we receiving a present participial form, a kingdom which cannot be moved." Now, the word "removed" in that context means to be radically formed, to cease to function in its original established, divinely established manner. And it says this kingdom that was being established in the first century will never be moved. Well, according to Steve's paradigm, and the paradigm that I was raised in, by the way, it says that at the end of time, the end of the Christian age, there will be no more evangelism. There will be no more teaching of the gospel throughout the world to save men from sin. Because there'll be no more sin. As Steve said, there'll be no more sin and no more the death. So I see that right off the bat as a tremendous fundamental problem. How can Steve affirm the end of that which the Bible affirms has no end? Now, mind you, it's talking about the kingdom established among men as a teaching, evangelizing, benevolent organization, organic body of man on earth. Ephesians chapter 3, 20 and 21. "Now unto him be glory in the church by Jesus Christ throughout all ages, age without end." So I think that is extremely critical. Now, Steve said that Adam and Eve began to die. I want you to notice what God did not say to Adam and Eve. You know, sometimes what God does not say, and I'm not arguing from silence per se, but I know what God did say. God said, "In the day that you eat, you will surely die." And Steve is correct when it says, "In dying you shall die," but he left out the fact that it says, "In the day." Now, he says they began to die. Well, obviously, Adam and Eve did not die for hundreds and hundreds of years later. But he says they began to die. But I want you to ask yourself a question. Did Adam and Eve come to know good and evil that very day? In Genesis chapter 4, Adam and Eve said that God had said they would become like gods, knowing good and evil, in the day you eat the fruit. Well, did they come to know good and evil that very day? The same day that they would die is the same day that they would come to know good and evil. Now, if they came to know good and evil that very day, then they died that very day. And that raises a question. Let's define death. James defines physical death. And we all know what it is, you know, because we lose loved ones. We know what physical death is. As the body without the spirit is dead, even so faith without works is dead. So James defines physical death for us. It is when the body and the spirit is separated. They didn't begin to die that day. So Steve's argument, therefore, has to be that they became mortal that day. But I want you to ask yourself a question. But notice what God did not say. He did not say, and the words do not say, "You will be sentenced to die." He did not say, "You will begin to die." He did not say, "You will become mortal." He did say, "In the day you eat, you will surely die." Now again, in the Bible, death is the separation of the spirit from the body. And we know Adam's spirit did not leave his body that day. So I think this is a tremendous problem. Now, ask yourself this question also. If Adam and Eve began to die or became physiologically changed the moment they sinned, and that's what's necessary in Steve's paradigm, as I understand it, they became physiologically now subject to death. So that raises a very serious question to me. If Adam and Eve were changed instantly, physiologically, the moment they ate the fruit, the moment they sinned, then why is it that the very day that you and I are forgiven of our sins through the blood of Christ, are we not instantly physiologically changed? Is this not the counterpart? Is Christ not the solution for the problem? The problem is sin and death. The problem was the law of sin and death. The law of sin and death, according to Steve, as I understand him to be saying, the law of sin and death was they sinned that moment they were physiologically changed. They became, quote, mortal that day. I believe that logically that demands that the moment that you and I are forgiven of our sin and we stand redeemed and spotless in the blood of Christ and in God's eyes, in that condition that Paul said, blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not impute sin, I suggest that in Steve's paradigm, this would logically demand that we are instantly physiologically changed. But obviously that's not true. I'm growing old. Steve, I noticed you got some gray hair too. saw some pictures of myself from about 15 years ago the other day. When we consider what Steve is arguing, it seems to me that there's a tremendous, tremendous problem on that. Now, Steve said, Adam and Eve were not actually excluded from the presence of God. They were simply excluded from the tree of life. What did the Garden of Eden represent? Did it not represent the tree of life? Excuse me, did it not represent the very presence of God? Is that not where God walked and talked with man in the cool of the evening every single day? Now, we certainly have no record whatsoever of God walking and talking with Adam and Eve once they were kicked out of the garden. So there's most assuredly a sense in which they were excluded from the presence of God. Furthermore, when we come to, we can go to Hosea, we can go to Isaiah. The Lord's arm is not short that he cannot save, neither is his ear heavy that he cannot hear you, but your sins have separated you from your God that he will not hear you. Sin most assuredly separates from God. So it wasn't just the tree of life that from which they were separated. They were separated from the presence of God. Now I'm trying to hurry through some things right here in order to spend some good time on John 5 and Acts 3 and 1 Corinthians 15. He raised an interesting point that I think, to me, is troublesome for his position. On Hebrews chapter 9, that Christ came, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil. If I understood you correctly, Steve, you were saying that Satan has the power of death today. Well, that means that even the child of God is still under the power of the devil. Does it not? Because every Christian, ostensibly redeemed, ostensibly forgiven, through the blood of Christ, is still under the power of death. Now, I heard Steve say in one of his presentations on his website that physical death is still the enemy of the child of God. My question here is why? How can physical death still be the enemy of the child of God if the child of God has been forgiven of the very thing that ostensibly brings that death? And why does the child of God die? Because sin brings death. The wages of sin is death. Well, if that's physical death, and I as a child of God am forgiven by the blood of Christ, why do I still die? That means that the most faithful child of God, the moment they die, it is a manifest, undeniable demonstration that they are still under the power of Satan, still under the power of sin. Well, what happened to the atonement? What happened to the substitutionary death of Christ? You know, in correspondence, I asked Steve, did Jesus die a substitutionary death? And he shared with me what is undeniably true about all the different views of atonement, all the different views of Jesus' substitutionary death. You know, there's the forensic view, and there's this, and there's that, and what have you. Well, that's true. In the final analysis, he agreed with me that Christ died a substitutionary death. Well, look at it like this. If Jesus' death, physical death, was a substitutionary death to save you and me from the death of Adam, then he failed miserably, did he not? Because that means that you are not. You know, there's a 100% death rate from the time of Jesus until now, even for the most faithful Christian. So if he died in my place, that's what substitutionary means. If he died in my place so that I don't have to sin, then he failed because I'm going to die physically. Absolutely inescapable. So in what way is the death of Christ ineffective or efficacious if I, as a child of God, who is ostensibly under the power of that death? Now, it's not enough to say, oh, but yeah, but you'll be raised from that. No, that's not the same as saying he died in my place as a substitution. Likewise, the atonement. If Christ died an atoning death to pay the penalty for my sin, then I shouldn't have to pay the penalty for my sin, i.e. physical death. But I'm going to die. So for whose death or for whose sin am I going to die? Well, my own. Then that must mean that Christ's death, Christ's atoning death, has not been applied to me very well. Now, I could go on and on. I'd really like to spend a lot of time on that because I really believe that this is a major, major problem in the normal views of the death of Adam and eschatology as a whole. Now, believe me, folks, I was raised believing exactly what Steve presented to you. That was the view with which I was raised. Now, let's take a look at John 5. Steve drew a dichotomy, drew a contrast in John 5, because Jesus said, the hour is coming and now is, in which those who hear the voice of the Son of Man will live. They have passed from death to life. And he says, see, that's right then, that's right there. But notice that Jesus then said, but the hour is coming. So therefore, that must be a different event at a different time. Well, I would invite your attention back to John chapter 4. In John chapter 4, as Jesus was speaking to the woman at the well, he told her, woman, if you knew who it was who talked to you, you would ask him, him, and he would give you water that would spring up, you never thirst again. And of course, she said, well, give me this water so I never thirst. I don't have to come bail water again. And Jesus said, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, in which men shall worship neither in this mountain or in Jerusalem. Okay, that's the hour that was then. But then what he says, notice what he says, and the hour is coming, in which men shall worship God in spirit and truth. Well, that's not a different hour, separated from Jesus' that then present hour by 2,000 years. It's the same hour. This is really a Hebraism, simply expressing something, and it's not dichotomizing those two events into two tremendously disparate events of two totally different natures, by the way. So let's take a look a little bit further at John chapter 5. One thing that jumped out at me as I listened to Steve's good presentation here is one thing that was absolutely and totally missing. He failed to mention even one single time that whether we're talking about John 5 or whether we're talking about Acts 3 or whether we're talking about 1 Corinthians 15, he failed to mention something that I repeatedly brought up last night, and that is that the resurrection was the old covenant hope of Israel after the flesh. Now, let me make this point because I think it's very important. Perhaps it will help Steve understand a little bit better my position here. The problem of Adam was carried from Adam to Moses. Death reigned from Adam to Moses. Romans chapter 5, verse 14. That problem of the death was then exacerbated, compounded by the entrance of the law. The law was added that the sin might abound. Romans chapter 5, verse 20 and 21. But the death that entered through Adam, and the promise of the overcoming of that the death, was then incorporated into and assimilated into Israel's Old Covenant prophecies. While Israel and Torah can be viewed as a, quote, interim system, it was a system obviously divinely ordained by God to help prepare for the coming of Messiah and the solution of the original problem. But the original problem does not stand distinct from Israel. It was incorporated into Israel and her promises. That is why I took note last night that the promise of the resurrection is nothing, or I should say, cannot be separated from Israel's festal calendar. Paul tells us in Colossians chapter 2 that the new moons, the feast days, and the Sabbaths were, at the time that he wrote, shadows of good things that are, present tense, about to come. Now notice what he says, the new moons, the feast days, and the Sabbaths. Now every feast day was a Sabbath. What did the Sabbath represent? Well, first of all, the Sabbath was a covenant between God and Israel. And the Sabbath foreshadowed the final, ultimate, soteriological rest with God. It represented resurrection. Now, I could cite, if need be, I could cite rabbinic sources after rabbinic sources and scholarly sources after scholarly sources, all of whom agree and teach on this. There's virtually no disagreement that I'm aware of anywhere on the part of any scholar that the feast days, or I should say, that the Sabbath, and especially the Feast of Sukkot, the Feast of Harvest, the Feast of Ingathering, represented, symbolized, and foreshadowed the feast days. Now, in that regard, I'm getting ahead of myself just a little bit, but let me touch on just this just a little bit anyway. Remember that Paul said Christ was the first fruit. Now, I am going to touch on this even more here momentarily. I hope I don't run out of time. You see, to a good Jew, reading that text, and Steve mentioned the Greeks, that would be in Corinthians, but Paul is still using Hebraic thought. He is using Hebraic terminology, and he's referencing Old Testament prophecies made to Old Covenant Israel. Again, as we shall see here momentarily. For Paul to reference that Christ was the first fruit meant one thing. And oh, by the way, from a technical perspective, Christ was the first fruit of the first fruit. Christ was the first fruit of the first fruit. The Feast of First Fruits was the day of Pentecost. And then you had, and that represented the beginning of the harvest. And that's why James could say, of his own will begat he us by the word of God, that we should be a kind of first fruits unto him. James chapter 1 and verse 18. That's why Paul could say that the resurrection had already begun in Philippians 3, even 1 Corinthians 15. And in a host of other passages where Paul could speak of the resurrection as an ongoing, already present thing, that's why in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul uses the present active indicative as well as the present passive indicative 10 times to speak of the resurrection already being in process when he wrote. With what body are the dead being, present active indicative, being raised up? It is not a future tense at all. It is with what body are they being raised? And so it is critical that we honor these things. But back to Israel. No matter what Steve thinks of John 5, or 1 Corinthians 15, or any of the resurrection passages, it is the salvation hope of Israel. Paul said, as he anticipated the adoption, the redemption of the body, Romans 8:23, that promise of the adoption belonged to Israel after the flesh, Romans chapter 9, verse 3. Now, was that promise made to the righteous remnant? You know, Steve and I visited on this just the other day, and he and I agree it's the righteous remnant, but it doesn't exclude the fact or negate the fact that it was the righteous remnant of Old Covenant Israel, to whom those promises were made, to whom those promises had to be fulfilled. Now I want you to notice something very, very quickly, and I've got to pass on here. In Daniel 9, it predicted the salvation of Israel by the end of the 70 weeks. But the 70 weeks ended no later than AD 70. Isaiah 25-27 predicted the resurrection of the dead. How do I know that? Because Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 says, when the mortal shall I put on immortality, then will be brought to pass the saying, death is swallowed up in victory, quoting Isaiah 25, verse 8. The new creation, when death would be destroyed, is found in Isaiah chapter 65 and 66. Now, Steve, it seems to me, is divorcing John 5, 1 Corinthians 15, from its prophetic roots, and he posits it at the end of the Christian age, but as we've just seen, the Christian age has no end. That doesn't work. Certainly doesn't work in my paradigm. to me, these are very, very powerful problems that Steve really must confront. Now, I asked Steve, in written correspondence, at what point of time and in what event or events were or will all, not just some or most, But all of God's old covenant promises made to old covenant Israel after the flesh, completely fulfilled or fully accomplished, and his covenant relationship with her terminated. He answered, I believe that Luke chapter 21, 22 answers the question that was in AD 70. I suggest to you folks, let me put it like this. Even if I do not understand fully all aspects of the nature of the resurrection, and I'll tell you right now, I don't know if anybody understands resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15 better than this man sitting right here, William Bell. He astounds me at times in his knowledge of the resurrection. You know, I can muddle my way through it at times, but he has a tremendous, tremendous grasp of 1 Corinthians 15. I almost wish he was up here at times. So, but here's the key to this. If we cannot bring our eschatology within the framework of the fulfillment of God's old covenant promises made old covenant Israel, then I would suggest that we have the wrong framework. Steve's framework for the resurrection is the end of the new covenant age. Paul's framework for the resurrection is the end of the old covenant age. Okay, let me go on very, very quickly because William's already been waving the banner over there. He mentioned that. I just got to bring this up. John chapter 5, 28, 29, for the hour is coming, in which all of those who are in the grave shall hear the voice of the Son of Man, shall come forth, some to life, everlasting life, some to everlasting condemnation. Well, you know, folks, last night I brought up Daniel chapter 12, that at the time of the end, some of those who are in the dust of the earth shall arise, some to everlasting life, some to everlasting condemnation. And to my very great pleasure, Steve said, I agree, that's AD 70. Well, here's the interesting question. Where did Jesus get his doctrine? Now, remember, Jesus came to confirm the promises made to the old covenant promises, or fathers. Romans 15, verse 8. Paul said his doctrine of the resurrection was nothing but the hope of Israel found in the old covenant prophecies, found in the law and of Moses. So my question is, where from the Old Testament did Jesus get his doctrine of the resurrection of the just and the unjust? Where did Paul get his doctrine of the resurrection of the just and the unjust? Or Acts chapter 24, verse 14 and 15. Do you realize there's only one Old Testament prophecy that specifically mentions and predicted the resurrection of the just and unjust? Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, which Steve says was fulfilled in AD 70. Well, I agree with that. But to me, it places a tremendous burden of responsibility on Steve, since Jesus seems to be drawing directly from Daniel 12, since Paul seems to be drawing directly from Daniel chapter 12, and Steve says, no, Daniel 12 is AD 70. So where is the passage in the Old Testament that predicted the resurrection of the just and the unjust that Jesus and Paul was referencing? Okay, Steve referenced Acts chapter 3. I want you to point out, and he talks about this being the restoration of creation, etc., etc. Well, I agree, but what is the creation? What is the restoration of all things here? And I just simply do not have time for this. Perhaps in my next negative, I'll get back to Acts chapter 3 because I really want to share some things with you. But I want you to notice that just like Paul, Peter said that his hope of the coming of Christ out of heaven, however we want to understand that, and the restoration of all things, the Greek word is apokatastasis, an extremely significant word, one that is tied directly to the ministry of John the Baptizer. I'll just drop that little hint to you right now, because John was Elijah who came to fulfill all things. He had already started the restoration. Well, if John started it, Jesus was going to finish it. But that still ties it to the first century. All right? But notice that Peter said his hope of that restoration was foretold in Samuel, in Moses, yea, in all of the prophets who have ever written. And he said that the restoration would be when those things what? When those promises made to old covenant Israel fulfilled. Well, once again, you see, Steve, in my understanding of his position, and like I said, I used to be an amillennialist, says, no, well, God was already through with Israel. No, he wasn't, because God's promises to old covenant Israel, including the redemption of the, quote, body, which is a singular word that is used with a plural adjective over and over, Paul anticipated the redemption of the body at the second coming of Christ in fulfillment of these old covenant promises. Now, let me see if I can get something else in there. I want you to notice that Peter's speaking of this restoration of all things. All right, let me go very, very quickly on down here to something. I'm going to introduce this. In Acts chapter 3, Peter said that he was anticipating the fulfillment of all of Israel's promises at the apokatastasis, the restoration of all things. And by the way, this would be the time of the putting away of sin foretold by Daniel chapter 9. And it's the promise of the parousia. It's the fulfilled. It's fulfillment at the parousia. And Peter spoke. Notice what Peter says. Peter, speaking of the fulfillment of all of those Old Covenant promises, the restoration of all things, Peter said all of those Old Testament prophets spoke of these days. Now here's what's significant about that. As Peter anticipated the parousia in 1 Peter chapter 1, the parousia to bring salvation, Peter said, of this salvation the prophets have searched and inquired diligently that they might know the time and the manner of the coming of this salvation. To whom it was revealed that not to themselves did they minister those things, but to us. You see, the contrast is between the days of the prophets who spoke of things far off and Peter's these days. So whatever the restoration is, whatever the restoration of all things is, Peter said, those prophets spoke of his these days. But look at Hebrews chapter 9 and the parallel. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 6 all the way into chapter 10, the writer of Hebrews spoke of the fulfillment of Israel's cultic festal calendar with its new moons and its sacrifices. And he said, those things, those sacrifices, those feast days, would stand valid until the time of reformation. This is the Greek word diorthosis. Diorthosis and apokatastasis are synonyms. Okay? But follow me here. This would likewise be the time of the putting away of the sin. Jesus came at the end of the age to put away sin. Daniel said 70 weeks are determined to put away sin. But when would it be fulfilled? At the parousia, Hebrews 9:28. And now, to those who eagerly look for him, Greek word that indicates imminence, he shall appear a second time for salvation. And when would he appear? Hebrews chapter 10, verse 37. And now in a very, very little while, the one is coming, will come and will not tarry. I don't know if you can read this or not. But I pointed out that restoration is apokatastasis, and deorthosis or reformation in Hebrews chapter 10 is deorthosis. Don't get lost on the pronunciation, okay? Apokatastasis, restoration, deorthosis, reformation. Apokatastasis is at the second coming, finalized at the second coming. Hebrews chapter 10, the time of reformation, would be at the second coming. But the old covenant system would stand valid until that time. So follow my argument. My argument very simply is this. The apokatastasis, that is the restoration of all things, and the time of the Reformation are synonymous. They are the same time and the same event. That means that the restoration would occur at the time of the Reformation. But the Reformation, the time of Reformation, would be at the end of the old covenant age, Hebrews 10, verse 10. Those Old Testament feast days, new moons, Sabbaths, the cultic practices, the writer of Hebrews says, would stand valid. And by the way, there would be no entrance into the most holy place as long as they stood valid, and they would stand until the time of Reformation. Well, that means at the time of Reformation, man could enter into the most holy place. Why? Because Christ had appeared to open up the way at the time of salvation. But again, when did he say it would be? In fulfillment of Israel's old covenant promises, in fulfillment of Israel's feast days, it would be at the time of the second coming. And he said in Hebrews 10:37, and now in a very, very little while, the Greek term is very, very powerful, it's hoson, hoson, mikron. In a very, very little while, the one is coming, will come, and will not tarry. So I would suggest to you again, we have evidence here. We have the emphatic time statements. We have a framework. A framework that Steve did not mention even one single time. Now, Steve was quite eloquent in his speaking about the body. He was speaking quite eloquent and impassioned, obviously. And I know he believes this with all of his heart. This is never an issue here. But to me, the foundational issue that is being overlooked is this starts with the Eden, to be sure. It's assimilated into Israel's promises, and the fulfillment is invariably posited at the end of the Old Covenant age of Israel, that occurred with the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, or to refer again to Hebrews chapter 10 at the end of the Mosaic cultic system. Thank you very much.